If natural law represents only the reason of God, it would be unalterable by God. This is unacceptable to Christians who have this idea of an omnipotent God, and so natural law cannot clearly embody only the reason of God. But on the other hand, if natural law were to embody only the will of God, it would be arbitrary. And that's also bothersome to the kind of rationalistic intellectual minds of the Neo-Thomists. And there are therefore, for Neo-Thomists at least, two important consequences of thinking of natural law as embodying both the reason and the will of God. First of all, the laws of nature obviously have to reflect the laws of God. I mean, this is kind of trivial. But second of all, and this is at least for political purposes probably the more consequential point, if the law of nature is also in some sense reason itself, if it's reasonable and it's tied to the divine reason, we don't have to have, human beings do not have to have any kind of special revelation in order to grasp and follow the essential principles of natural law. Any basic adult rational human being can grasp natural law. It's been planted within us, it's been imprinted on our minds. Now, the Neo-Thomists stress the capacity of all human beings to apprehend natural law in order to reject the idea that the establishment of particular political regimes is ordained by God. In other words, what you can see hiding behind here is a Catholic attack on Protestant political polities. If a Protestant comes along and says, well, you know, you have to obey this Protestant monarch because all monarchs have been instituted by God, and that's just the way it is on classic Lutheran political theory, the Catholic defense of that is, no, I can divine by my own reason that this polity contravenes natural law, and that therefore I can resist it. The Neo-Thomists, in other words, want to demonstrate, first of all, that any particular political polity has no natural existence. You can't say that the Kingdom of France in this particular construction or in this particular distribution of power has been so ordained by God. And they also wanted to demonstrate that commonwealths have to have been brought deliberately into existence. And they're not natural excrescences, if you want to think of it this way, of the workings of the cosmos, but they're human creations. They've been brought into existence by concerted actions on the part of the citizenry as a means of fulfilling mundane ends, having more security, having more property, being able to enjoy the fruits of their labor better. And this argument that commonwealth, any particular polity, has no natural existence but has to have been brought into being as a part of a rational process, this led to two further questions. First of all, what is the state of nature? And the answer to that is, at least according to the Neo-Thomists, one in which all people are free and equal. The second question which then emerged from this is, well, if in the state of nature all people are free and equal, why would you want to set up a state at all in the first place? The argument again was, well, for security, to preserve the common good against the destructive consequences of private ambition, so on and so forth. But you can see that there was already kind of a standard in place there, that insofar as a polity was supposed to be an improvement on the state of nature, that set up a standard by which, according to natural law, any particular political arrangement could be criticized. So Neo-Thomist natural law thus provides a really powerful argument for resistance to tyranny, and it works as follows. If a tyrant contravenes natural law, his commandments are not binding. If a state is turned to purposes fundamentally at odds with its raison d'être, the preservation of the common good, and so on and so forth, the monarch could be resisted. Thus we find, again in Suarez, who had insisted, you'll recall from an earlier lecture, that the monarch is above the people, the assertion that if a king is actually attacking the commonwealth with the aim of unjustly destroying it, there is a right of self-defense, which makes it lawful for the community to resist its prince, and even, in fact, to kill him, if it has no other means of preserving itself. Now, Suarez is appropriately cautious. He does limit this right of resistance. He says the ruler cannot be merely injuring the commonwealth, he must be warring against it. A couple of burdensome taxes is not enough. It has to be, you know, the complete confiscation of property to, you know, impoverish the entire population. Second of all, Suarez insists that the right of resistance is not located with private citizens, but with a representative assembly of the whole commonwealth. Again, this is a classic early modern move, and as you'll see in one of our later lectures about the way that societies were set up in this period, you'll see that this has a class bias into it. In other words, the insistence that this right doesn't rest with the common people is also a way of saying it has to come, resistance has to come from the appropriate channels, from the appropriate authorities, and that's usually social and political elites. Almost all political theorists in early modern Europe are very wary of granting too much political autonomy to the peasants and other dirty rabble. Nonetheless, when all qualifications have been made, there is still an irreducible constitutional principle there, a standard by which a monarchy or any other polity can be judged, and if found wanting, and if it's resistant to correction, can be corrected if by force if necessary.